Hey guys, this is Mike Mahaffey, the old bastard BJJ guy, here for BJJ Metal Models. Back in my day, we had to walk uphill in the snow both ways to get to the academy just to learn some crappy technique from a random purple belt. You kids have it so easy, because now you can just subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium and get tons of great audio courses to learn new techniques, enhance your mindset, and entertain yourself. You can even get personalized rolling reviews from some of your favorite BJJ Metal Models coaches, including me. It's like having your own seminar, you spoiled little whippersnappers. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium right now, get off my lawn, and go train.
Hey, welcome to BJJ Mental Models, episode 221. I'm Steve Kwan. BJJ Mental Models is your guide to a conceptual and intelligent jiu-jitsu approach. And today, at long last, I'm pleased to be joined by Joseph Chen. Joseph, how's it going?
Very well. How about you?
Also very well. I mean, you're in a very different time zone than me. It's nighttime over here. It's morning over there. But I greatly appreciate you making the time because I've wanted to have you on here for quite a while. It's funny. I remember Sonny Brown shot me a message a while back and said, I just had Joseph Chen on the podcast. You got to meet this guy. You got to learn more about him. He's a big fan of Bernanke. He follows your stuff. But your name rang a bell. And then I realized you'd sent me a listener message like many, many years ago, back when we were at, I think, episode 10 or something, just when we were getting started. One of our first fan messages was actually from you. And flash forward now, it's crazy to see how much you've accomplished since then, man. I mean, I hear your name everywhere. People have said you would be an amazing guest. So I'm super happy to finally get you on here.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I don't remember which episode I started listening to, but obviously, like, there's some degree of connection. I don't know if you know, but like my original coach back in Nanjing, China is under Rob Bernanke, and Rory had come down to visit. And so via them, I got to hear about the podcast. And then it was around COVID time and when I started listening a lot because I had nothing else to do. So yeah, very, very cool to be here.
Yeah, it sounds about right. I think there was a lot of people who got a lot of podcast listening done during that period of a few years. A weird time, but yeah, it's good to have you on here finally. Now, for those of you out there who don't know Joseph, probably would be good to do an intro. Joseph, do you want to just do a quick explanation of who you are and how people might know you?
Sure, yeah. Well, I would say I'm a jiu-jitsu competitor and currently training out of B-Team. However, right now just traveling. Probably know me from either Who's Number One, Pans, or Andrew Tackett.
Now, where is your home base exactly? Because, I mean, when I first heard of you, I'd heard that you were, I believe, overseas. But if you're training with B-Team, how exactly does that work? Do you train remote or have you moved over stateside?
So I'm not based there, but I go and visit and do my camps there primarily.
Got it. That makes sense. A lot of mutuals then. I mean, we've had a lot of guests here in the past who are affiliated with that team. So happy to have you on. But man, something I wanted to explore with you. I'm going to kind of shamelessly steal this from Sonny Brown. I know he had an awesome chat with you about rapid learning. And I fully believe, of course, that, you know, whatever Sonny does, we can do better. So let's do that. I want to talk to you about this and about how you've gotten so good so quickly. Now, like I said, it wasn't that long ago that you were just getting started at jiu-jitsu. I remember getting messages from you at the time. But now, you know, you've busted onto the world scene. And one of the things that's been ultra impressive is how quickly you've done that. Most people take, you know, as they say, 10 to 12 years, whatever it is, to get the black belt. But you've been clipping along pretty quickly here. Talk to me about that. Like, what's your process look like? And what are the things that you do differently that's allowed you to accelerate your learning like that?
So, like, similar to what I talked about on Sunny, I actually credited this podcast a fair bit because, especially, I started listening to this podcast when I was an orange belt. And so that definitely introduced me to many ideas that I wasn't necessarily familiar with, especially back then. And that brought them into my mind where I could start considering them and looking to apply them in training, whether it be like various like distances of guard or various phases of guard play, et cetera. And so it definitely made it a lot easier for me to think about problems, and it, for lack of a better term, gave me more tools to deal with the problems that my partner would give me. And so I definitely think that helped a lot. However, there, like, over time, I definitely have been influenced a fair bit by, like, obviously, I read Art of Learning when I heard it on this podcast, and then I just did a bit of thinking on that, and then read some other books, and then watched some YouTube videos, and then slowly it kind of, I wouldn't say I took everything from one place, but it's kind of like a mesh of like information that I found from different places.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, that's probably the preferred approach, to pick and choose and consult different sources of information and find different things. I mean, we've always tried to be unique in the fact that because we're audio only, we can kind of innovate within that constraint, and we can spend a lot of time talking about why you would do things or maybe how you would do them. Whereas when you get visual, a lot of the time it's more about monkey see, monkey do, right? The coach shows, put your hand here, put your leg here, just copy. So I think it's cool that you've gone and you've consulted all of those different resources, but let's maybe expand upon that a bit. I mean, many people, when they think about jiu-jitsu studying, they think about, okay, I'm going to watch a boatload of instructionals. Or they think about, okay, I am going to just train in the gym a ton, just put in a lot of mat time. And those things are definitely going to help you. But what's interesting is some of the examples you've brought up here are kind of outside of that. You know, you've talked about learning from podcasts, learning from books. And I can't help but wonder if having a diversified intake of knowledge like that is one of the things that's helped you out. And so maybe talk to me a little bit more about that. What are some of the ways that you decide where you're going to get your info from? You know, prior to hitting the record button, you'd kind of mentioned some unorthodox sources of information that you've consulted. Probably good to expand upon that here.
Yeah, absolutely. So it wasn't necessarily very intentional, but I think my curiosity took me to places outside of jiu-jitsu, where I was relatively familiar with the resources that we had within. And I believe this is similar to when the podcast first started. There was some Danaher instructionals, but I still found those very hard to on-take, especially back then. But so, like, I think probably the first thing that led to me thinking like this is, first of all, like in The Art of Learning, Josh Waitzkin talks about two different ideas that I think are quite opposing, and that kind of inspired me to take this idea elsewhere. And now I see it similarly in other areas, where he talks about form to leave form and numbers to leave numbers, as well as making smaller circles. And for me, at least the way I interpreted that information, I saw them as kind of contrasting methods to approach training. And eventually that turned into like what I would call growth versus performance, and two different ways to train. And so I thought of that and then started thinking of how I can approach training that way. And then I've seen similar YouTube videos about, there's this gaming channel called Core A Gaming, and they have a few YouTube videos on talking about how to improve at video games. They specifically talk about like Street Fighter / Tekken, but we can talk about that more in a bit. But yeah, very, very useful idea, in my opinion, in which you kind of make the distinction between improving versus actually like being good at competing, if that makes any sense.
Actually, it makes a ton of sense. And it's something that I'm personally very passionate about, drawing that distinction as well, having a different mindset for when you go into training mode versus when you go into competition mode, and how hard it can be, especially for a competitor, to juggle the relationship between those two. Before we dig into that, though, you know, you talked about one of my favorite books. You talked about The Art of Learning by Josh Waitzkin. And like you mentioned, I think we've been talking about that since, oh boy,
forever.
Yeah, the beginning of this thing. I mean, this podcast was very much inspired by the work of Josh Waitzkin. For those who haven't heard me prattle on about this guy for a long time, the relevant thing for us is he's a black belt under Marcelo Garcia, and he's heavily involved in the creation of Marcelo's MG in Action Academy. And he's also the author of The Art of Learning, which is an amazing resource for sport-based skill development and building a mindset conducive to learning. But what's interesting about Josh is, before he got into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, he was probably best known for being a child chess prodigy and being the inspiration for the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer. And then he actually went out of that, went into martial arts, went into competitive Tai Chi, of all things. I didn't know that there was a competitive Tai Chi, but there is.
Neither did I.
Yeah. I actually saw some of his footage. And I guess the way that you would describe it is, it's kind of like judo, but without the gi, and kind of with an emphasis on like arm drags and wrist grips. So you have a pretty limited tool set. But the idea, as far as I can tell, is you're still trying to get the person to the floor. You know, I don't think you're going to see someone go into MMA with a Tai Chi base and win a world championship. But in terms of, is it a valid competitive martial art in and of itself? It certainly seems to be that way. And so the interesting thing about Josh is this is a guy who has succeeded at the highest levels in multiple different fields. Clearly, he's very good at the art of learning. And in this book, he put down his core tenets for how to go about doing that. Now, you touched on a few of these. And of course, because Josh is a Tai Chi guy, he kind of has a tendency to talk a little bit in a mystical sense. You know, if you're used to Danaher, where everything is very clinical and descriptive, when you read Waitskin, it's a little bit more kind of like martial artsy. I would definitely want to get your explanations of these concepts. So form to leave form, which Josh also sometimes calls numbers to leave numbers. How do you explain that? You know, it's kind of hard to break that down for someone who's never heard this stuff before. But if someone were listening to this and they'd never read that book, but they wanted to kind of get the gist of what that concept means, how do you explain that to people?
So, yeah, absolutely. Actually, what's funny before I go into that is that I believe he competed in the Tai Chi World Championships, whatever that is, in Taipei, which is where I'm at now. So it's actually kind of cool. Anyways, what I mean by, at least my interpretation of form to leave form, I use form to leave form as opposed to numbers to leave numbers, since I find that it's more applicable to jiu-jitsu. However, from my understanding, it's more of a idea in which you're looking to take explicit knowledge and make it more implicit, or at least bring in a lot more intuition, in which you don't have to consciously think about what you're doing, but it's more of an instinctive reaction. And I think for me, at least in the way I talk about growth versus performance, I would put form to leave form in the performance area, where you're looking to take skills that you've been consciously working on and bring them into your subconscious so you're able to do them, especially in situations in which there's greater pressure. So in competition, you don't necessarily have the time and have the reactions in which you would have in the gym. It's going to be a lot more high paced. It's going to be a lot more aggressive. And so you can't really rely, at least you can't rely all the time on you actively thinking out of these situations, because a lot of the situations that you're presented with now are going to be far more time sensitive than they were in the gym, because people are going to be reacting super fast. People really care about the outcome. So very different. And so that's how I see it fit in.
Yeah, that's very much similar to my definition as well. I mean, you talked about how Josh kind of confusingly has two names for this concept. He also sometimes calls it numbers to leave numbers, which he calls it very specifically as a chess reference. And so for the same reason as you, I prefer to use the other name he sometimes uses, form to leave form, because it's more specific to the martial arts. And the meaning behind the words is you practice the form until you don't need the form anymore. Basically, until, like you said, you've internalized it to the point where it just becomes intuitive and you don't so much need to think about it on the fly, because you sort of moved it into your muscle memory. And that frees you from the burden of having to think really deliberately about these things so you can make faster, better decisions. It reminds me of that old quote. I think it's from Salo Habero. The famous quote about how in jiu-jitsu, you know, if you have to think, you die. I can't remember the full details, but basically, like, if you have to think, you're screwed because your opponent is already one step ahead of you. And form to leave form, it to me is very much all about that, right? It's about that process of moving things to your muscle memory so that your brain can focus on higher level things. And the example I always give is, you know, when you're a white belt, if I ask you to do an arm bar, you're going to have to sit there and think very deliberately about every single micro step because it's all new to you. But after you've been training for a few years, if I tell you to do an arm bar, it doesn't require a lot of cognitive load for you to do that. And what that means is that your brain can be focused on things like strategy and deception and misdirection and that kind of stuff, the fun stuff, right? All of the nuts and bolts, your body just kind of learns to do on its own. At least that's the definition I've used. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds very similar to how you explained it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that.
Awesome. Now, the other item you brought up, also from Josh's book, is he talks about making smaller circles. And again, a concept that was very formative for me, but I would want to hear in your words how you've applied that and what that concept means to you in practice.
Yeah, so I talk about this in terms of like two opposing strategies to approach your training. So one would be form to leave form. The other would be making smaller circles, which at least, again, in my interpretation, I would hate for someone to like interpret it another way. And now they're like, what? I don't say it that way. So my interpretation is that it's similar to taking what you already have and looking to refine it, try to take a lot of the nuances and then make them conscious. So you're able to think of different ways you can use them. So for example, like the example you were talking about earlier is like this armbar transition, wherever it may be from. If you're able to do it intuitively, it's hard to make adjustments to. So if you want to change something about it, whether it's foot placement or timing or weight distribution, etc., it's going to be hard when it's stuck in like a very intuitive state. So for me, making smaller circles would be trying to make it less intuitive, more conscious. And so you're able to start to make these adjustments. Also, you're able to think more deeply about this technique in ways where you can think about, oh, how else can I use this in other areas? Is there a different way I can do this? Is there a difference, like sequentially, can I do it in a different order, et cetera? And so I'd say it's like you're making one, like let's say you have one item and then you're breaking it down into much fewer items and seeing what you can make of the, it's a very interesting description, but what you can make of now the separated items.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of two things that they're related, but they do on their surface appear a little bit opposing, right? On one hand, you're talking about the process of making things so automatic, you don't even have to think about them. But on the other hand, now you're talking about deliberately thinking about things and stripping away the non-essential and kind of focusing on what's really important. And that's one of the things about jiu-jitsu that I found really a challenge to get my head around is that there often are not any absolute answers. A lot of the time, it's a polarity, it's a spectrum. Sometimes you do things one way, sometimes you do things the other way, and it's all just very context dependent, right? And kind of learning to think flexibly like that was a big change for me when I kind of stopped looking for the right magic answer that was always true and then started looking at things on a spectrum, sort of like how you just described.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I view them as like another something that really solidified this idea is I watched this YouTube video by Corey Gaming in which they talked about innovators versus honers as a like in terms of in Street Fighter, how there are players who are innovating these specific techniques that have already been established versus innovators where they're just trying to think of crazy new ways you can start looking to use pre-existing technique. And so I think of them as two very necessary parts to your approach to jiu-jitsu because I find that if you only have one, like let's say you're only looking to like improve technique in terms of like finding new technique to work on, etc. However, you don't take into account this performance aspect, then you can know very many techniques and you can understand all of them. However, when you're put under pressure, it's going to be much more harder for you to use them, especially in a competitive situation. As opposed to, I think there are other people that only focus on performance in which they only train hard. It's always under pressure. It becomes a lot harder for you to start incorporating new techniques, new strategies, etc. So I view them as both very necessary, but you kind of have to go between like an ebb and a flow of one versus the other.
Yeah, yeah. That's really great and interesting advice. I mean, so many people you will hear in jiu-jitsu the mantra, you know, I only study what works at the highest levels. And if you don't really have a game plan or a good starting point, that's a good practice, right? Take a look at what the pros are doing and copy them. But the problem is if you're just copying people, by definition, you're not breaking new ground or innovating. You are, like you said, you're honing. At some point, though, sometimes the big gains come from breaking outside of that box and innovating and trying new things. And it takes a certain level of experience to know when it's a good idea to, you know, shut up and listen to someone else and just do what everyone tells you versus when you should disregard common knowledge and try your own thing and try to break away from the pack. And there is no right or wrong answer, right? If you are an intelligent grappler and you're looking to grow, you're always trying to figure out for any given situation, okay, what's better here? Do I listen to everyone else or do I ignore them and do my own thing, which has maybe never been done before? And maybe it's going to be a terrible idea and a total flop, but there's that 1 in 100 chance that you're going to discover something or you're going to break ground in an interesting way that gives you a leapfrog advantage going forward.
Yes. Oh yeah, most absolutely. Like we may as well, like, since we're talking about Josh Waitzkin already, he has another idea called investing in failure. And I feel like that's another example of it. So Yeah, you can see a lot of these techniques, like especially recently, like the smother tap that a lot of the new wave guys like Luke Griffith, Big Dan, and Gordon tried doing to Pedro Mourinho. What they've been using, I think that's something that would have been disregarded. However, like it's been clearly shown to be quite effective at like a decently high level. So I feel like people always talk about like efficient technique where it's like, oh, it needs to be perfect placement. And I wouldn't say that technique's not efficient, but you have to also like take into efficacy of a technique. And so I think balancing those two as well is also very important when it comes to like your training.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, hey, I love the smother personally. I mean, I'm not going to say that you're going to go and you're going to get a world champion to tap out by smothering them. But if you want to talk about efficiency, there's basically nothing more efficient than just like sitting chest down on top of someone and just not letting them breathe while you don't move. Like you can't get much more efficient than that. And even if you don't get the tap, you know, you can start instilling panic. You can frustrate them. You can make them create openings that they might not have wanted to create. You can expose weaknesses. And it is funny you bring that up because I remember, you know, back in the early days of the UFC, you might remember this. There was a period of time where everyone was playing around with covering the other person's mouth. This was just a thing. Like everyone used to do it. All of these guys, as they were grappling, they'd constantly be trying to cover the other person's mouth and nose to cut off oxygen. And then at some point, I guess people decided that was just a stupid thing and they moved away from it. But it's interesting that now the smother is kind of coming back, right? I mean, suffocation is a powerful strategy if you can do it. It's hard to do against a good guy, but you know, if you're mounted on someone and they can't go anywhere, it's a very good way to drain their cardio down and demoralize them.
Yeah, most definitely. I think like stuff like that, it's like, it's very valid and very useful to play around with. Because even if you come to the conclusion that now, okay, this is something that has mild utility, but it's not really useful against everybody. Like, I think it would be very difficult for, let's say, a smaller man to smother a bigger opponent. I would say that might, like, that would be reaching a bit, but it still has, like, it is still functional in the sense where there are going to be times where it's very useful for you.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you talked about the worship of efficiency. In jiu-jitsu, we're always looking for efficiency, but efficiency doesn't just live in a bubble, right? Efficiency is often kind of relative to what your opponent is doing. If they're defending something very, very well, it's going to be hard for you to do it efficiently because they're making it difficult for you. So you do a technique on someone who isn't defending it well, and it might be very efficient. You attempt the same technique against someone who defends it well, and it might be a real struggle to make it happen. So efficiency can be relative, and that's where innovation comes into play, because sometimes you can find a technique that just your opponent doesn't expect, right? If you can pull something out of your bag of tricks that they don't see coming, they often fail to defend it. And if they fail to defend it, you're going to be more efficient at doing it than if they put up an intelligent defense. So sometimes efficiency isn't just about doing things textbook perfect, but it's about finding the thing that your opponent didn't think you were going to do, and then you use that to attack them when they don't know how to defend properly.
Yeah, most definitely. Actually, something that I also think is quite relevant to this conversation we're having right now is actually, I think of efficiency as like, not like, it's not always the best option to, like, I also like to think of things in terms of appropriateness, where in situations where you find you can't be efficient, it probably means that you're not doing the most appropriate technique. So I think there are very like specific cases where that might not be the case. And I think something I like to think about in my mind is the balance between doing something that's efficient versus something in which you have confidence in. So like in my mind, I think of appropriateness versus your confidence in a technique, and in which you can start balancing the two, because I'm sure everyone who trains has their preference for what techniques they use and which techniques they have confidence in. And so they have a tendency to favor or lean in the direction of the techniques in which they feel like, okay, I have confidence in hitting this, I have a general understanding of it, versus what techniques are most appropriate in that situation. And I think, well, like what we were talking about before, like this growth mindset, or like in this, when you're training for growth, it's important to like zoom out and kind of think about a situation, not in which what you would want to do from here, but what would be the most appropriate thing to do from here. And I think that's very important when training and trying to find new paths to take when you get frustrated, per se, or you meet resistance.
Now, I would love to hear you expand on this. I mean, you already talked about this kind of polarity here between innovators and honers and how people can kind of deviate or move to one side of the equation versus the other. But another interesting polarity that you've been talking about is growth versus performance. And this is something that, especially talking to competitors like yourself, I'm always curious to hear how you people think about this stuff. So talk to me a little bit about this. Like, you've talked about these two different mindsets. What do they mean to you? And how do you balance your mindset, like going into growth mode versus going into performance mode? What does that look like in practice for a high level competitor?
So we're going to talk about it in practice. Generally, my reasoning in which, or what would basically guide me to choose one versus the other, would be, do I have a lot of spare time? Do I have any competitions lined up? So if I have a competition lined up, I'm obviously going to focus a lot more on being able to perform. So versus if I don't have any competitions for the foreseeable future, I'm going to try to think about new ideas, what I can do with the stuff I already have, etc. So breaking them down, I would say performance is similar to what I said before about formerly form. It's trying to make a lot of things intuitive, trying to get a lot of reaction time, trying to gain confidence in the techniques that you already have. Versus growth would be similar to making smaller circles, where you're trying to bring this, like a lot of the stuff that you have done very intuitively, into this area where you're able to think about them more deeply and try to incorporate new ideas, new techniques, see how new ideas that exist outside of your game, how you can incorporate that into your game, as well as maybe there's something that you've been doing for a long time that isn't very necessary, trying to think critically about this game that you already have. And I think one is refining information almost, and that you have already in your game, and the other is on taking or taking away information. But that requires a lot more thought. And so I think that wouldn't be necessarily conducive to performance, because let's say I went into a competition and I'm thinking about every move I'm going to do. It's going to be, unless it's like, if it's a very good competition, it's likely that it's not going to be best for me, because similar to what I was saying before, a lot of these things are very time sensitive. Unless I'm far better than my opponent, it's going to be very difficult for me to think my way through everything. A lot of times you need to react intuitively to a lot of these situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And this ties into another concept you talked about earlier, again, which Josh Waitzkin talks about in his book, and that is investing in loss. When you're generally going into a competitive situation, of course, your priority is to win. And that usually means you're focusing on your A game, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're trying to learn and you're trying to grow, you're actually probably going to be focusing on the things you're not good at. And that's hard for people, right? Because you have to do things that you suck at, and no one wants to feel like they suck. So something that Josh Waitzkin talks about in his book is learning to view losing not as something that's taken away from you, but rather as an investment in your growth. And by changing your mindset in that way, it becomes more comfortable to go into these losing situations and to play your B game, for example, where you're not necessarily going to dominate. It can be hard for people to do that. But when you're in the gym and you're training, that's the mentality you want, because just going into the gym and doing competition roles every single day, trying to win, you're just going to wind up practicing the same techniques over and over again. You're not going to be trying to add new tools into your game plan if you're afraid to lose.
Yeah, most definitely. Like, and I wouldn't say that it's exclusive to the training environment. Like, you see a lot of people, they'll go into lower level competitions and practice a lot of their B game just so that they get practice, or they get time practicing a lot of their B game under the pressures of competition. Because a competition isn't just you against an opponent. There's this whole environment in which that exists. And I think it takes practice being comfortable. And you see a lot of people who, they work on a lot of different things in the gym and they have confidence using them, or at least a mild degree of confidence. However, once you start trying to use this in a very high pressure situation in the environment of a competition, there are many eyes on you, it becomes so much harder to do. And so you see a lot of people trying to go into competition, or at least like lower, you see like grappling industries, Nagas, or even lower level IBJJFs trying to implement new parts of their game. And I think that's also a very good strategy that you can start to incorporate, in terms of one, trying to like have more confidence in the technique that you've been working on.
Yeah, that's something that I believe our mutual friend Robert Deagle has talked about, and how he likes to compete at lower level competitions, mostly to build up that competitive muscle, right? Competition is a skill in and of itself. And by going in and doing these competitions, it gives you a degree of stress inoculation in a situation where the stakes aren't that high. It also allows you, like you said, in some cases, to try new things that you normally wouldn't be willing to try in a high level competition, because again, the stakes are different. So I think that's a great approach, and probably something that people don't deliberately try enough, right? They kind of assume that once you're at a certain level, you only compete at that level. But just like how there's benefits to competing with training partners at all levels, probably you could argue that there's benefits at competing at tournaments of all levels as well, especially considering how in jiu-jitsu, it can be hard to get a lot of tournament time, right? I mean, just the way we structure things, a lot of these tournaments are one and done. So trying to maximize your tournament time while spending as little money as possible doing it is probably a wise thing for most competitors.
Yeah, most definitely. It's like, and it can be quite daunting, especially I think a lot of people, like especially myself included, I get in my head when I compete, and especially when I want to try work something new, I get very nervous, especially because there's this game that I associate as my A game. And so when I look to deviate from that, I get a lot more nervous than if I were to not do that. But I think it's also like similar to what we talk about. There's like a lot of these things are very necessary in order for you to improve.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you had talked earlier about the relationship between gaming and jiu-jitsu. And man, I got to tell you, I've been waiting 5 years for someone to come on the podcast and bring this up. I have always wanted to explore that relationship. I mean, for people who haven't figured this out, I'm a big video game fan. I've been a gamer my whole life. And you're not the only person who is brought this up. In our community Discord, we've got a guy named Minstrel. I don't think anyone even knows his real name. I'm not even sure if he's a human being or if he's a bot, but he does a lot of study of this stuff. And he's particularly talked about some of the lessons that competitive gaming can teach jiu-jitsu. And I think this is where, you know, probably a lot of jiu-jitsu athletes would open their eyes and learn a lot. You know, if they think that competitive gaming is just sitting on your couch and playing Xbox, like, man, you don't understand. High level competitive gaming, like the stakes and the level of performance that is required, arguably is more intense than jiu-jitsu in a lot of ways at the high levels. I think people don't understand exactly how serious high level competitive esports are. So with that said, man, I got to turn the table over to you. I want to get your thoughts on this and what you've learned from that process as it applies to jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, most definitely. So something I actually want to bring up, which I think is quite relevant, is that like jiu-jitsu, though it's been around for quite a while and definitely more than video games, if you think about like the amount of people training jiu-jitsu versus the amount of people playing video game, I haven't done the research, so maybe I could be wrong, but I doubt it. But I would bet that there are far more, like many times more people playing like even one video game than practicing jiu-jitsu, at least at a competitive level. So I think there is a lot that can be taken, even not just from gaming, but even from other arts. So similar to how we're talking about chess versus like other arts, where we can take a lot of things that they've learned and they apply in their training into jiu-jitsu. And I may be wrong, but did John Thomas used to play games competitively? I thought somewhere in my mind, I feel like he used to play League of Legends or something like quite competitively, but I could be wrong.
I don't know for sure, but if there's someone in the jiu-jitsu community who used to be a competitive gamer, I would believe it was John Thomas. You know what? Actually, let's just start that rumor right now. Let's just say that John Thomas was a competitive esports player. Make that stick.
Maybe I'm wrong, like, but somehow I think that's somewhere in my brain anyways. But yeah, so I definitely do think there are a lot of parallels between gaming and jiu-jitsu, especially because they're both very competitive sports. And I think there's a lot that can be taken from video games and how people look to get good. Like, I think like what you were talking about before, a lot of people think of games as like playing on your couch or like just playing on Xbox, as you were saying. That's just like the most casual version of video game. It's like, if you were to think of jiu-jitsu as just like training once a week and you're like the mother who just comes in and you try to think of her as a competitor, it's like jiu-jitsu serves different people in different ways. And I'd say video games are the same. Video games shouldn't just be taken, okay, there's the hobbyist or there's the professional. Same as jiu-jitsu. Like you can't compare the hobbyist versus the professional. So it's very different things. But in terms of video games, like you see a lot of games like, for example, Street Fighter and Tekken, they're like hyper competitive, as well as Call of Duty. And so you can take a lot of the strategies people use to get good in games like that and try take them over to jiu-jitsu. So like a lot of the things I was talking about before was inspired by videos that I watched about video games. Another book that I really like, it's again, a gaming book. It's by, what's his name? Oh no, I can't remember this guy's name. It's a Japanese guy. It's called The Will to Keep Winning. And he's like one of the first pro gamers in the world of Street Fighter. And he has a really nice book that talks about a lot of these ideas in depth. And I think it's very interesting because you could almost like, if you just replaced a few words, you could almost think he's talking about jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the thing about video games that's fascinating, right? Is if you abstract away what you're talking about, they're basically pure tactics and strategy, right? I mean, in jiu-jitsu, if you try to take a muggle, someone who never trains jiu-jitsu, and you make them watch a jiu-jitsu match, they're going to have no clue what's going on, right? You kind of have to have physically done jiu-jitsu to understand it. But video games, that is pure tactics and pure strategy. And you can learn a lot by studying that, right? That's actually one of the interesting things. There's probably a lot more crossover than people think when it comes to good strategic decision-making. That's actually kind of the inspiration for this podcast. This all came about because we realized that a lot of the ways that you would make good decisions in life, you know, or look for patterns, a lot of the mental models cross over from different sports to different industries to different professions. And yeah, you can actually learn a lot about strategy by studying what people in other sports or in other endeavors do. And sometimes that can give you a really fresh take on things that you might not have thought about yourself just by immersing yourself in whatever sport you normally play.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, because if just, I would say that especially in sports that have existed or at least existed competitively for longer than jiu-jitsu has, there can be a lot that can be taken from various arts, like whether it be boxing. You hear a lot of boxing analogies in jiu-jitsu. You can hear a lot of judo crossover. Like, I think there's something to be taken from like most other areas. It's just a matter of being open-minded enough. And like, I think in your attempts to try to find new information, there's going to be a lot of failure, because though there are many similarities, obviously there's significant differences. However, I think that's what you kind of have to expect when you're looking for not necessarily a competitive advantage, or just to try to find new ideas and try push it a little further.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes you look at something that's unrelated, and even if there's not something directly applicable, it might be enough to just at least get the idea jump-started in your head. I mean, that's one of the things about jiu-jitsu. There's kind of a sort of a pretentiousness about our sport in a lot of ways, where because jiu-jitsu is so effective and kind of was proven in the cage, people often, you know, they glamorize jiu-jitsu at the expense of the other martial arts. I remember once going to a seminar with a very prominent black belt, and he, you know, kind of proudly proclaimed that we do jiu-jitsu because it's hard, and if you want to do something easy, go do karate, which honestly is not really a smart thing to say. I mean, some of those variants of karate, like, you go tell a Kyokushin black belt that their job is easy, like, oh man, like, I mean, you know, there's different levels to this stuff. They're not all forms of karate are the same. And even if something isn't necessarily going to win you an MMA championship, even if it's not necessarily the most effective self-defense art, just the fact that there's a practice and that there can be strategies involved, some of those can still be applicable, right? I mean, anytime there's a game or a competition, you can learn strategic lessons by observing. It doesn't have to be jiu-jitsu. And sometimes even these other martial arts, you know, the kind of more traditional ones, even though they might not be super effective as a combat sport, by learning the strategies that they employ against each other, some of that can be more transferable than you would think.
Yeah, most definitely. Like, it's like people who say jiu-jitsu is easy because you look at two people double guard pulling and just butt scooting. It's it's not necessarily a good representation. Like, I do think like jiu-jitsu is fairly difficult, but then you look like jiu-jitsu is something that can still be practiced by people who are significantly older in age or significantly less athletic. I think if there's like this, how did you describe it, as like people thinking like being a bit more snobby about jiu-jitsu, is like, if you want to find a harder art, you should probably look to like freestyle wrestling, Greco, or even judo. Like, you don't really see those practiced as casually, because like the risk for injury and the physicality required is much greater, I would argue, than jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things I love about jiu-jitsu, especially the gi, is it can be as hard as you want it to be, right? Especially in the gi. If you don't want to work hard, you can slow the other person down and, you know, kind of drag them down to your level and turn it into a very energy conserving game. But you're not required to do that. You can also go 110% if you want. However, it is true that a lot of people in jiu-jitsu, myself included, honestly, like to slow it down a bit. But yeah, I agree with you that you look at some of those other arts and there's a kind of a higher emphasis on intensity. It's the reason why every time a high-level wrestler walks into the room, all of the jiu-jitsu people get scared, is because they know what's going to come with that, right? Whereas you know that jiu-jitsu is, you know, it's pretty chill and pretty relaxed most of the time, and you don't really have to worry about someone just like planting you onto the floor and smashing you to the same extent that you would in something like wrestling. But then again, that's not to say that one approach is right or wrong, but it just goes to show that there are things that we can transfer from other martial arts regarding the mindset or the strategy, things that might be unique or interesting differences from what we do in jiu-jitsu every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I think it's like important to distinguish, once again, like the growth versus performance. Something that I really interested me earlier was this earlier, as in like a few months ago, I was actually there for a part of a day for Alexander Volkanovsky's camp for Islam Makhachev. And it was crazy for me watching like them train, because they put a lot more emphasis on physical conditioning than jiu-jitsu practitioners do. And it's like worldly different, where they put, like, they were doing, like, these 30-second rounds, which it was insane. Like, I was just doing one of these 30 seconds out of five, and I was already tired. And so, just in terms of, I do think that there's, like, benefits to both, and there are differences. Like, I think a lot of what makes jiu-jitsu unique is that it's far more approachable, and, like, what you said before, it's, like, you have the ability to slow it down. But for me, as, like, a competitor, I think, like, obviously, like I said before, jiu-jitsu serves different people in different ways. Sometimes it can be just a way to work out versus like a competitive avenue versus a way to meet friends, etc. And I think like people who say it's only one thing, I would think are kind of just putting it in this little box, where it's like, I feel like jiu-jitsu is so wonderful because it can be so many things to different people. But like I was saying before, like for me as a competitor, watching that and seeing how a lot of MMA athletes, they take their physical training a lot more seriously than, at least in my experience, jiu-jitsu athletes do. And I think it's actually like incredibly different. And so I think, once again, like we were talking about taking things from other sports and bringing into jiu-jitsu, that's something that I have been considering to try find ways to bring into jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've kind of gone onto a deviation over the past few years where we've tried to bring guests on here who aren't necessarily jiu-jitsu people. They might be a blue belt in jiu-jitsu or a purple belt, or maybe they don't even train jiu-jitsu at all, but they've got some very relevant expertise in a related field that we have reason to believe is transferable into jiu-jitsu, right? I mean, a lot of the things about sports psychology and about skill development are going to be very similar regardless of what sport you're doing. I mean, the details are different, but the learning tips and tricks you might use might be very similar. And jiu-jitsu is a very new art, right? I mean, the quote-unquote founding of jiu-jitsu, the sport's only really technically about 100 years old. I mean, yes, it's a deviant of other martial arts that have been around for longer, but jiu-jitsu as we identify it has a very, very short history of, you know, just around 100 years or so. You compare that to other sports, some of which have been around for, you know, thousands of years or longer. I was talking to Nick Perler on our premium series a while ago. We've got a whole series of premium conversations with him. Nick is the head of the Perler Wrestling Academy, which is one of the largest and most successful wrestling academies in the States, particularly for high school athletes. And, you know, the stuff that they do is completely different just in terms of the level of rigor and diligence into how they train athletes, because they've got thousands of years of practice in terms of how to make people succeed at the sport. Whereas you look at jiu-jitsu and, you know, man, most people didn't even know about jiu-jitsu until two or three decades ago. It's just, there's so much that we can learn from these other disciplines. And I think it's important, like you said, not to get too snooty about it and not to focus so much on jiu-jitsu that you refuse to take the lessons from other arts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, yeah, similar to what you were saying before, it's like, I feel like there needs to be a certain level of humility when it comes to like talking about other arts, because like similar to how a lot of people may have ignorance about jiu-jitsu, I'm sure I'm very ignorant about other martial arts as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we're probably going to start to see a lot more cross training, because you brought up a great point. Like MMA guys, they do quite a bit different from jiu-jitsu people. I think they're a very obvious example of an art that we could learn a lot from. So I think that bit about keeping an open mind is a great idea. I would love to hear how you do that. You know, in practice, there's so many things that you can learn that are outside of regular jiu-jitsu curriculum. How do you find new and interesting things to learn or to study, which might be a bit off the beaten path?
So in terms of different ways, I find that there's not necessarily a certain way that I can look to find new information, but I think there's a certain like degree of randomness. It's like you come across something that you find is interesting. Sometimes like out of my own interest, I'll go into like a YouTube rabbit hole and something completely unrelated, and I'll find, oh, that's a very interesting idea in which I'll try to think how that may apply to jiu-jitsu. But generally, I wouldn't say there's like a specific way you can look to find new ideas, especially existing outside of jiu-jitsu, because there's so much unknown. It's like, it's not necessarily something you can just, okay, other things that apply to jiu-jitsu and you Google search it. And so a lot, for me, at least in my experience, a lot of it's stumbling onto new information just through curiosity.
Yeah, I think just generally having a curious mindset probably helps a lot. You know, like you said, if it were so easy to know what to study, then everyone would just be studying that thing. But sometimes the good ideas, there is a degree of randomness if you just are actively curious and you're looking to learn about new, seemingly unrelated things. You might stumble onto something and discover some connections that were there that you had no idea about.
Yeah, and actually something related to that, I think it's actually quite important to, at least for me, to delve into topics that aren't necessarily jiu-jitsu, because something I've been quite wary about is the risk of burning out, especially when I go into more depth when studying jiu-jitsu, whether that be instructionals or a lot more like intense training. I enjoy jiu-jitsu, and so I generally want to keep it that way. So I don't want to make it a situation in which, okay, I'm constantly watching jiu-jitsu tape, constantly watching instructionals. I'm always training, because I have gone through periods of that, but that I don't think that's a very sustainable way to train. So I try to broaden whatever information I intake to a lot more different areas, whether that be, once again, like I was talking about before, video games, or even just various forms like reading different books, etc. Like sometimes I like to watch anime, just to kind of avoid this idea of burnout. And I feel like that's something that a lot of people can sometimes neglect, because people can be a lot more, you know, like hardcore about their training. And I think, obviously, if you're able to sustain that, and if you can do that, I think that's wonderful. But for me, at least, like, I do enjoy jiu-jitsu, but if it consumed my whole life, I would find it very hard to continue to enjoy, mm-hmm. at least for a very long time.
That's a really great talking point, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I think this is something many jiu-jitsu professionals don't take into account properly. When you start this martial art, there's something about jiu-jitsu that is just really, for a lot of people, yourself, myself, and surely the listeners included, there's something very addictive about it. It's very common that once people start jiu-jitsu, it kind of becomes all-consuming for them, and it just becomes a passion. And a lot of people understandably make a decision that this is what they want to make a career out of. And it can get to the point where jiu-jitsu consumes your whole life. And that's where things like burnout can become a problem, because, I mean, like with any relationship, it's not going to be, you know, passionate and always positive forever. You're eventually going to get past that honeymoon phase. I mean, I know I did when I got to brown belt. You know, I'd been training for so long that, you know, the beginner's passion had sort of worn off, and I just kind of found myself in a bit of a funk, and it took me a while to get past that. And I think it's important to especially teach our athletes that they need to have more in their life going on than just the jiu-jitsu. Not just because of the reasons you brought up before, like how you can actually learn things from other endeavors, but also because it kind of hedges you against burnout. It allows you to live a more balanced life. You're not doing the same thing all the time. You have some variety. You can take some time off and go do other stuff. It's okay, and it's a good thing to have other hobbies and other interests. And I think that that's something that we often don't prepare our jiu-jitsu athletes and coaches for, which is to diversify their life a little bit better than they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like there's something to be said about being able to spend a lot of time in deep focus. But that's why you see a lot of people, they have training camps, because you're not able to sustain that level of, let's say, that work rate and that level degree of focus for forever, or at least indefinitely. And so generally, like, for bigger competitions like ADCC trials or ADCC itself or Worlds, et cetera, whatever a lot of people do camps for, generally the reason why it's called a camp is because there's going to be a greater degree of focus and greater amounts of work put in compared to what is like what you would normally do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, something to explore on that note, you know, you're clearly a guy who's thought pretty deliberately about the difference between growth versus performance. Does this kind of factor into a schedule for you? You mentioned that you can't sustain like performance mode all the time. Eventually you'll burn out, your body will break down, you'll lose your love for the sport. And once that happens, you're basically done, right? I mean, I don't care how talented you are. If you lose your love for the sport, then it's going to be hard to sustain any level of performance. With that said, do you have like a schedule or an operating cadence where you try to deliberately spend certain amounts of time in performance mode versus in growth mode? Is it all keyed around the camps that you've got coming up? I'd like to explore how deliberate you are in terms of deciding, you know, when to flip the switch and go from one mode to the other.
So generally, I like to think of it usually in like either a month or 2 month cycles, where for a month, I'll think about, okay, how can I start looking to incorporate new things or what I can do with the stuff I already have? And then for another month, I'll go into a phase where I'm more, okay, how can I start looking to dial this in, whether or not it's in preparation for a competition. But when there is a competition, that's when it becomes a lot more solid. So at least for this year, I already have planned a bit of it. So for the time being right now, I'm in Taipei. So there's not too much high level training in which I need to like work on my performance. So I'm mostly trying to play around with new ideas, different strategies, etc. But later on, so towards the end of the year, it's during September and November, trials are coming up. So for the months leading up to that, like for like 2 months ahead of that, that's when I'm going to start looking to lean towards this performance aspect. And then before that, I'm going to try look to see what unique elements can I start looking to incorporate into my game that would serve me, especially for the goals that I have, which are the ADCC trials.
Got it. Now, one last thing I want to dig into here. For people who aren't professionals at jiu-jitsu, so for people who do this for fun, maybe they compete once or twice a year, maybe they don't compete at all, right? Maybe they're like me, they're just a pure hobbyist. How can people like that apply performance training to their game and kind of switch between those mindsets? Because I kind of feel like this is one group of people who really struggle with this. And, you know, I've heard Rob Bernacki actually talk about this too, and how sometimes the people who struggle the most with that competitive mindset are the hobbyists, because they don't have that rhythm of going off into a fight camp, going off into performance mode. The only thing they know is the training at the gym. So it all gets muddled together. They get their competitive juices going when they're supposed to be actually trying to learn, and vice versa. They don't have that distinction. I'm wondering if you've got any thoughts on how a person who's not a pro can still juggle those two mindsets and get the best of both worlds.
I think obviously you can be your own, like you can manage your own training in terms of periodization. You can choose when you want to do one versus the other. However, something that I do notice a lot more when I go into this type of training is that the positional rounds that I do cater to the one I like performance versus the growth. So in terms of deciding, I feel like you generally you can look to decide for yourself. And like, let's say you have a lot of things that you've been working on and you feel like, okay, I feel like that I have a lot of new things that I have in my mind, but I'm still not very confident in using that. And I think that would be a good indicator for you to start going into this performance, at least this performance part of training, or this performance centered per se, versus if you feel relatively confident with all the techniques that you have and you can't really think of anything that you're working on, that's when I would start looking to lean towards more like a growth mindset. And I think something that's quite interesting is thinking about how the positional rounds change during these two different types of training. Versus, so like, for example, if you were to focus more on growth, you try think of positional rounds that enable you to practice a lot of the new ideas and try enable a lower stress environment, but still allows for a resistance. Because something I think that is very important in training is bridging the gap between drilling, or just like what a lot of people think about, think of drilling as just no resistance, to open rolls, is actually this area in which positional rounds or specific rounds can be, or like what Rob Bernacki would call fuck your jiu-jitsu, becomes very useful. And so I think the nature of the rounds change when you focus on one versus the other. If you were to focus more on performance, the nature of the round would more be trying to put pressure on you, as in like mental pressure, as in, okay, things are time sensitive, I need to do things in a timely manner, versus the other where there's still pressure in terms of, okay, something like there's resistance being given, but it's not as time sensitive.
Got it. Makes a ton of sense. Well, man, I can't thank you enough for coming by and having this chat with me. Before we tie this up, I mean, I know that you came in with a lot of prep and you've got notes. Was there anything you wanted to talk about that we didn't get into yet?
Let me double check. But something I want to briefly touch on is something that actually, because I've been teaching a lot more recently since I've been traveling back home, something I think is very useful is, like, similar to fuck your jiu-jitsu, obviously I stole that from Rob Bernacki, I try to think of different rounds or specific rounds for whatever I'm working on. So recently, something that's been very popular is the idea of camping or J-point camping. And so when I started looking to develop this, I started trying to design specific rounds to plan for that. And I actually, I remember that you, I believe you guys did a few podcast episodes, the different phases of guard. So like the engagement phase, the maintenance phase, and the offense phase. And that's something I actually started using, but as the top player as well. So when thinking about guard passes, so for that, break up my positional rounds or my specific rounds into the engagement phase, which would be looking to either put an opponent onto their back or getting to an angle, and specifically working on that. So I've accomplished my goal of either putting my partner to their back or getting to an angle, you'd reset. And then the maintenance phase, which would be, I actually put out an Instagram video on this earlier, where the idea of maintaining an advantage over time. And so just practicing that purely. So just starting a positional round where you're in this position where you pass your opponent's legs, but they still have frames in place, and just holding that position and being comfortable dealing with guard retention, and then actually beating frames. And so I think, obviously, that's one example of how you can use positional rounds in your training to work on technique that you want to practice. But I think you can apply this to a lot of different areas. But I think segmenting it into these different phases becomes very useful, because now you're able to practice this specific skill and have a much shorter feedback loop, as opposed to just doing it as a whole in an open role.
Yeah, that's amazing advice, man. I agree with you. I think that's a great way to think about things. Having a more deliberate practice for your training, thinking consciously about what your goals are for a session, and kind of tailoring the role so that there's some rules to it. You're not just trying to win, but you're trying to practice a specific piece of the game. That's usually going to lead to better results because it's more focused, right? When you come to skill development, being able to cater and set the parameters for a role so that there's a goal, that's always going to be a good thing. But man, thanks so much for coming by. I do greatly appreciate it. I've been wanting to have you on here for a while. Hey, if people want to get in touch with you, follow you, check out some of your content, where would they go about doing that?
So for the time being, I'm mostly just on Instagram. I have a dead YouTube account that I used when I was an orange belt, but my Instagram is Joseph Chen, JozefChen, Jiu-Jitsu, so JJ. That's probably where you'll find me. That's usually, if you want to ask me questions or anything, that's where I'll be.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put the link to your Instagram then in the show notes. So if people don't know how to use Google, just open up the show notes. There will be a link. You can just tap it. You'll hit up Joseph on Instagram. As always, I'll also put a bunch of links to some of the resources we talked about here in the show. By the way, the book you mentioned, The Will to Keep Winning, I believe that was by Daigo, the famous Street Fighter guy.
Daigo Umehara.
Yeah, who had that amazing... I mean, look, you don't have to know esports to appreciate this clip. Yeah, I think, I'm sure you know the one I'm talking about, that amazing clip where...
The Daigo parry.
Yeah, the Daigo parry, where like... there is no come from behind victory that is more impressive than that. Like basically he had like an invisible sliver of health left in Street Fighter and managed to basically like block a super combo and then counter it and then win at the last minute. It was like the closest parallel I can think of was like Anderson Silva putting a triangle on Chael Sonnen and just like pulling it out of nowhere at the last minute. Fantastic ending. And the crowd, of course, went totally nuts. It's cool to see that kind of enthusiasm about esports and not just regular sports. But yeah, thanks so much for coming by and sharing that. And of course, in the show notes, I'll also put a link to our stuff. Probably everyone knows. If you're listening to the podcast, I assume that you know where to find the podcast. But if not, BJJmentalmodels.com is the place where you can go and get, man, over 200 episodes now of us talking about this stuff. Additionally, you can also sign up for our newsletter. It is at least, if not more, popular than the podcast itself. We do a lot of analytical thought pieces that kind of expand upon what we talk about here on the show. So I would definitely recommend everyone sign up for that as well, since it's free. And of course, all of this, if you want to kick it up to the next level, that's where our premium service comes into play. Again, all of this you can get on our website. The main reason you'd want to sign up for premium is, first of all, we've got over 50 hours of audio style masterclasses on there from some of the best minds in the sport. You talked about Rob Bernacki. We're just in the process of launching our second course on there with him. Additionally, beyond that, we also do coaching. So if you've got rolling footage and you want to have an elite level black belt review it, just uploads footage there if you're a premium subscriber, and we'll get that routed off for you. I should clarify, when I say elite level black belt, I am not talking about me. We've actually got some really good black belts on the review team who break that stuff down. And of course, that's also your entry pass to get to our awesome Discord community. So again, all of that is part of our premium offering. BJJmentalmodels.com if you want to learn more. I'll put the link in the show notes. Anyway, that's it for my little self-ad read. But Joseph, thanks so much for coming by, man. I've wanted to chat with you for a while. Really great to have this conversation, and I can't thank you enough.
Likewise, thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Thanks. And of course, to all of the listeners, like I always say, I truly do appreciate that everyone spends so much time here listening to me yak every week. Greatly appreciate that as well. And we'll talk to you next time. Take care.